contingent on a lie. Because she couldn't possibly belong in a place like this. Could she? I'm not sure what to say, Nika stammered by way of thanks, because she truly didn't. Nonetheless, she accepted the card, finding it embossed with his name, seal, and office line.
You don't have to say anything. It's the least I can do for a student of Guan's, Dr. Santo said, bowing as he exited.
Benko Jin remained, even as his employer disappeared into the other room, his hands clasped behind his back and his shoulders squared against her.
That sets you apart, you know, he said, moving to take Dr. Santo's spot.
What? Nika scowled, stuffing the card into the sleeve of her glove.
That.
He jerked his chin toward her sleeve.
Hiding business cards like you're afraid of them.
I'm just surprised by his offer. It is, after all, a funeral.
You must be new, he said,
and she didn't love the surety with which he said it.
This is a gathering of the greatest minds in industry and technology, a rarity in this city. It would be remiss to hold sanctity over opportunity.
Nika scanned the huddled pods of conversation. Now that he'd pointed it out, she noticed how business cards passed between gloved hands, how conversations were scheming, not a tear in sight. Nika realized a fate worse than death, a funeral that bred not remembrance, but nepotism.
Since it's making you so uncomfortable, I'd be glad to take that card off your hands, he continued, holding out an expectant hand.
She turned away from him, crossing her arms to hide the spot in her glove where the card lodged.
I think I'll keep it. After all, Dr. Santo did invite me to join his research initiative.
Cochin's eyes narrowed, almost imperceptibly.
And why was he interested in you?
She heard the note of suspicion in his voice and felt the rise of indignation in her throat.
Why wouldn't he be?
Dr. Santo only takes interest in certain kinds of people. Cochin was careful with his tone, but she read his condescension from his words alone. He didn't believe Dr. Santo should have solicited someone like her. Nika only wondered which part of her he was disdaining, the Yarongi's part, the girl in rags part, or all of that together.
What kind of person does he take interest in, then? Someone like you? She snarked.
She sized him up, wondering what he had to even be arrogant about, and was disappointed to discover that he wasn't too hard on the eyes. He had that lighter Thuman skin, but his features still stood out in a crowd. Something about the elegant part of his hair, the intelligence in his black eyes, the way it felt as though he'd been born to wear that tailored vest suit. Among this crowd, she wouldn't have been surprised if he'd come out of the womb in it.
Yes, like me, he returned, as though she'd complimented rather than impugned him. I'm just surprised, considering the conditions of how we met.
I was in a rush, she said defensively. Her pride forbade her from apologizing to him.
That much was clear.
Nika imagined what kind of debacle a girl of this society might find themselves in.
I was running from suitors.
Amusement quirked in the corner of his lip, the first smile to reach his dark eyes.
I'm sure you get a lot of them.
His sarcasm did not go unmissed.
Suitors with nets and catchpoles.
A small stone of dread deposited near her heart. If he recognized those men as butchers, and if he knew the reasons butchers caught Yarongi's people, could he figure out what she was?
Don't worry. I won't tell anyone.
Cochin smiled, but it felt like a false offer of peace.
But girls in rags don't walk into silk overnight.
You're in over your head, Miss Swan. Nika let out a quiet breath. As long as he considered her only a girl in rags and not a blood carver underneath them, she was safe. With newfound audacity, she said,
Sounds like you're afraid I might replace you.
The discreet flare of his eyes told her that she'd guessed correctly, but he said,
Of course not. I just imagine your talents would be better suited elsewhere.
Outside of medicine, he meant. That insinuation was nothing new to her. That any Yarongis who held an affinity for medicine must have been a blood carver, or why else would they have taken such interest? Well, he happened to be right, but Nika would never give him the satisfaction of knowing that.
And what are your talents exactly? She pressed.
I take care of matters for Dr. Santo's research initiative.
Ah, so you're a secretary.
Cochin tweaked his cheek.
I prefer physician's aid. Doesn't seem so difficult.
Looks can be deceiving.
You know, Dr. Santo was just telling me about all the important people in this room, and he failed to mention you.
Oh? Then who did he name?
Mr. Nem and Mr. Ngoot. Nika realized then that she hadn't had the opportunity to finish her conversation with Dr. Santo due to a certain physician's aid. Cochin must have realized it too, because he grinned.
A short list.
Who else is of any importance here, then?
Everyone, was his brief answer. But he elaborated. Pick anything that interests you, and I'll give you a name. Interested in the forefront of deep-sea exploration? Mr. Alm's submarines can take you 600 feet under the surface. Want to see a film in color? Miss Lienva is changing theater. Want to see a man's bones through his skin? Dr. Vitt is inventing imaging film that'll allow it.
He rattled out the names with a sense of flippancy, as though he weren't listing revolutionary inventions, as if this crowd had long since bored him with their whims and miracles. Momentarily, she wondered what had jaded him. Perhaps it was regularity that bred boredom. This society produced marvels as the night sky produced stars, and even the sun might lose its luster if placed within the star belt. Somewhere, behind all the aristocratic arrogance, Nika thought she caught a glimpse of something real in his eyes. Resignation. Then his gaze met hers, and all that haughty charm returned.
You better not be hoping to fit your name on that list.
I'm just here for a funeral, Mr. Venn, she said. Not to be accosted by a secretary.
Cochin blinked in surprise, as if he'd been nothing but cordial.
Take my words not as harassment, Miss Swan. Take them as a warning.
A warning about what?
That you don't belong here.
Before she could counter, someone called her name. It was Trin, appearing from the other room and bowing to them both.
Excuse my intrusion, but our auto carriage has arrived to take us back to the manor.
He extended his arm for her to take, but it wasn't so much an invitation as a demand.
Nika withheld a sigh, wondering if Trin had only called the auto carriage once he'd seen her talking with Cochin. But anything for the Kongmis, she supposed, even if that meant he had to leave the wake early, too. She gave Cochin a bow, at once happy to be saved from conversation and disappointed to be chaperoned.
Pleasure to meet you, she said, the words of formality.
Likewise, he said. Before she could turn away, he'd taken her hand in his, silk against bare palm, and lifted it to his lips. His eyes watched her as he planted a kiss against the fabric, at once firm and gentle. It must have been a simple act of etiquette, over in a second, but Nika stiffened as though he'd nipped her. Her hand lingered in his for a breath too long, and she cursed the gloves, wishing she could feel this touch the way Thumans did, skin on skin, with nothing else behind it. Not his touch. He was a boy who wanted to push her out of this world, but someone's touch. A parting kiss on bare knuckles, rather than gloved hands around chafed wrists. Remembering his insults, Nika snatched her hand away. Only seconds had transpired, yet she reeled her mind back to Earth. Momentarily, she wondered why Cochin, who was so convinced she wasn't an aristocrat, would recognize her with a gesture of one. To save face before Trin when they both knew it was a mockery? Without another word, she took Trin's arm and let him guide her out of the estate. Though she didn't look back, she knew Cochin's gaze followed her.
Why were you talking to Dr. Santo's aide? Trin asked, voice edging suspicion.
He approached me. It would have been stranger if I hadn't, she grumbled, flexing her hand.
I obeyed all your rules, don't worry. You say sit, stand, beg, and I do all that. What did I rehearse my story for, if not to talk?
His expression flashed an apology, and he cast his eyes to the ground.
You're right, he managed to say, as though the words pained him. I shouldn't be so harsh.
Nika watched him out of the corner of her eye and saw the extent of the fatigue behind his words, It was a reminder that he was grieving, where she was not, so she remained quiet as their auto carriage rounded toward them. As she stepped inside, she removed her glove to free her hand, still burning, where Cochin had kissed her. 9. For the rest of the evening, there was no more Swan Ko Nika, just Nika in a library, trying to read, but instead occupied by thoughts of the wake, of Ven Cochin, and of those who might eulogize Mr. Kungmi in one breath and kill him in another. But she had no one to share her thoughts with. The siblings and Trin were busy preparing for the final day of the funeral, and not even Dr. Santo came by to visit. The last funerary custom, the procession, came the next day with the same guests in attendance. Unlike the wake, it was a stiff, orchestrated affair, which meant that Nika didn't have to worry about making conversation. For this, even onlookers joined in the ceremony, congregating as the procession rolled through the streets of the Dragonborough by hearse and marching band. It seemed everyone in these parts understood whose body lay in that coffin, and everyone stopped for a moment in bereavement or curiosity. That never would have happened in the Dogborough, not only because full processions were so rare, but also because the thick, sluggish crowds there never parted for anything. There was no sympathy for the dead when, on some days, death felt like a blessing. Their procession took them to a private cemetery, a gated lawn scattered with tombs and headstones bound by one similarity, the Kongmi name. Nika frowned at that, this little patch of grass in a metal city reserved solely so that a few dead might be remembered for nothing more than their name. But she felt a twinge of envy for the Kongmi siblings, whose long lineage was apparent in the sprawling tombstones, and she morbidly realized they'd end up here too, laid to rest, eternally surrounded by family. There were certainly worse ways to go. Flowers were left, speeches were given. Journalists and photographers crowded outside the locked gates, cameras clicking and flashing with blatant disregard for the mourners. The pallbearers lifted the coffin into the mausoleum, disappearing behind its stony walls and emerging again bereft of burden and casket. Now Nika watched the siblings. Mimi was a sorry sight, makeup running with her tears, and Andau must have sprouted a dozen more white hairs overnight. It seemed masochistic to draw the funeral out over so many days. One had been enough for her, and now Nika itched to return to the library. She got her wish soon, in a way. The procession retired to the Kongmi Manor for a feast, and Nika got to witness the grandeur of the banquet hall, which made the Kongmi's private dining room look like a puddle beside an ocean. Here, curtained windows spanned the walls, overlooking the front lawn, and lifting the viewer's eyes toward the wooden caisson ceiling. The servants had prepared the tables, which were draped and dressed like dancers circling one another in a ballroom. Gold accented the white across the room, yellow chrysanthemums blooming in bouquets of white lotus atop every table. The guests settled as they filed in, and Nika found herself seated between two chatting men and an older woman, none of whom seemed to notice her as they made themselves comfortable. She recognized the men as Mr. Nem and Mr. Ngut, remembering their faces from the eulogies and their names from Dr. Santo's introduction. They were both candidates for commissioner. Up close, there was nothing to set either of them apart from the average Thuman, other than trim suits and brocaded gloves. Yet Nika knew she was a mortal at a table of deities, of commissioners and multimillionaires and geniuses. It made her feel smaller than her 18 years, like a child sitting with adults for the first time. Food came before long, the dishes separate rather than shared. Though her stomach flipped, she obeyed etiquette for the sake of the Kongmis and waited for all the plates to arrive before digging into hers. She appreciated how the room fell to a relative silence as people ate. At least she was not alone without conversation. But the quiet didn't last before guests resumed their discussions, now over food. The older woman at Nika's right was talking to her partner about the meal, while the candidates had rounded toward respectful conversation about the late Kongmi. It harrows me to think I might have been one of the last people to speak to him while he lived, said Mr. Ngoot, wiping his lips with a napkin. If I could go back to that phone call, I would just tell him not to make the drive.
No one could have known, replied Mr. Nem. I have plenty of regrets with the late Kongmi that I'll take to the grave myself.
You two always were at odds, weren't you? Mr. Ngoot reminisced.
I wouldn't say that we were at odds, Mr. Nem corrected promptly. But, knowing each other as long as we did, we were sure to run into disagreements. Though, never something that a night at the bar couldn't smooth over.
Nika slowed her chewing as unsolicited thoughts came to her. Were these motives, perhaps, for murder? The events of the funeral had distracted her from such thoughts, but now her interest renewed. Her eyes explored the room in an attempt to hide her eavesdropping. They met Ven Cochin's. He snapped his gaze away, returning his attention to his table and tenting his bare hands in an idle gesture. Despite the innocuous act, she realized he'd been watching her, and Nika felt the hairs on her neck rise.
Yeah, wrong anymore, right?
Mr. Nem was saying, and the word dragged Nika's attention back.
Maybe so, Mr. Ngoot responded, but Mr. Kongmi loved the island. Shame Daltony never reopened the country in his lifetime. He would have had a lot of things to say.
Like what? Nika spoke up, and they turned to her. Blanching, she cleared her throat and adopted the speech she'd observed at the wake. Excuse me, I couldn't help but overhear your conversation. My name is Swanko Nika. She dipped her head in a short bow.
Nem Bok Kenyi,
Mr. Nem introduced himself. He was a large, broad-shouldered man, with the same demeanor as a bear standing on its hind legs. Gesturing to Mr. Ngoot, he said,
And this is Ngoot Lienborn.
You're Yarongese, aren't you?
Mr. Ngoot asked crudely, eyes gliding over her coarsely. What gave it away? The golden brown of her skin? The darkness of her eyes? The freckles on her nose? She nodded, already regretting the conversation.
I just never knew Mr. Kongmi was interested in Yarong.
When most people talked about Yarong, it was usually in the context of the tragedy, the wastefulness of Daltony. Nika couldn't blame them. That was the only piece of Yarongese history relevant to Thumans. But she would not have been surprised if Mr. Kongmi, worldly as he was actually interested in the culture of the island.
Oh, he loved the place. Are you from the island?
Mr. Ngoot enunciated the last part, as though she might not understand him if he spoke too quickly.
Thuman born and raised.
Great misfortune what happened there,
he continued, though his performative tone betrayed his aloofness.
It's such a shame, really. I'm sure the place is crawling with Daltons now. Warmongers, all of them.
Well, at least that was something Nika could agree with.
Yes, she said. A true tragedy.
The bigger tragedy is that we've let Daltony keep spreading their influence across the island,
Mr. Nem interjected, and she gleaned that there was more he wanted to say that he withheld for propriety's sake. She was doing the same.
Yes, absolutely, she agreed, nodding along.
Sarcasm came to her by instinct, and she bit it back from her voice, because the truest tragedy of Yarong's fall was that, in a circuitous fashion, it had landed her here in this stiff conversation with these two bland men. The next entree arrived then, and Nika took that as an opportunity to remove herself from their conversation. The food was plentiful, with a variety of courses, overflowing cups, and desserts to follow. Nika ate far past a respectful threshold, hoarding calories as a miser hoarded chem. As dinner ended, guests dissolved from the tables and banquet hall, disseminating around the mansion and chatting over goblets of wine. Nika left with them, escaping conversation and candidates for the respite of a quiet library. Still in black morning attire, she returned to the shelves, finding her stack of books untouched. A few guests came and went, admiring the shelves and the whale skeleton, and Nika felt oddly territorial, as though this was her space they were invading. She headed for her books, turning the corner around a glass case of primate skeletons, and found Ven Cochin. One leg draped over the other, he sat at the bench she'd used to study, her stack of books before him, and one open in his lap. Only when she halted before him did he look up.
"These are yours?" he asked, scrutinizing the stack.
"And what of it?"
"Never took you for a reader."
Nika scowled. "Never took you for a stalker." Unaffected, he exchanged the book in his lap for the next one on the stack.
"Studying for something?"
"Call it a personal interest." She narrowed her eyes at him, knowing he could understand these textbooks just as well as she could. But would he be observant enough to connect all the dots? The anatomy books, her Yarangi's origins, and their run-in on the streets. Would those clues so obviously spell blood carver?
"Is that why Dr. Santo solicited you?"
he murmured, as though talking to himself.
"You've expressed interest in medicine?"
"More than he could ever know."
"Aren't you his aide?"
Nika tilted her head innocently, though the words were a challenge.
"I thought he told you everything."
Kochin examined her, too carefully for her taste, and his next words were deliberate.
"Your name doesn't come up in conversation. I'm just curious why you've caught his attention at all."
Before she could shoot back, "Why not?" he asked.
"So, you're staying with the Kongmis?"
"How did you know that?"
He gestured to the table.
"The books, obviously." When she didn't deign to respond, he tilted his head toward the open seat beside him.
"Come, sit. I won't bite."
She had her reservations, but Nika joined him on the bench.
"You sure enjoy monopolizing my time. What if I plan to network?"
He made a quick scan around the room.
"There's no one else here worth talking to," he determined.
"And you are?"
"I'll let you decide. Trust me, I've heard the stories of everyone in this room."
His eyes wandered again, dancing between the laden shelves, the taxidermied birds, and the whale skeleton. At last, they landed on her.
"Everyone, that is, except you."
Nika caught the irony in that. Kochin was so quick to disdain her background, yet he found such interest in it.
"What's there to know?"
"How do you know the Kongmis?"
"This again?"
Nika tamped down her annoyance.
"I studied beneath their father. I'm only staying for the funeral."
"And then, back out of town?" He lifted his brow.
"Maybe, maybe not. I'll have to see."
She remembered the card from Dr. Santo, a ticket into the society on a false identity.
"What would keep you here?"
Nika mulled the answer.
"What would drive me away?"
He flashed her a look, and, without honoring her with an answer, stood. Dropping the book back onto the table, he said,
"You're interested in Hendon's condition, aren't you?"
Nika straightened all too quickly, eyes narrowing as she watched him with renewed interest.
"You know about Hendon?"
Trin and the siblings had given her the impression that Hendon's condition had been a secret. Kochin's smile was cold.
"I'm Dr. Santo's aide. He tells me everything."
At that, he straightened, brushing the dust off his pants.
"Anyway, I won't keep you any longer. Wouldn't want to monopolize your time."
He turned to leave, but she stopped him.
"You keep asking me about my story, yet you haven't told me yours."
He must have been around her age, but with the wealth and splendor of Thumis behind him. She didn't want to believe he had worked for it. Better to deplore him if he'd been born into it. But then, where was his family at these functions? Kochin halted mid-step. When he met her eye, his look held something between apathy and sadness, but he was quick to regain his composure.
"Nothing to tell," was all he said before walking away.
Nika watched him leave, but he didn't return to the dining room, where most of the guests socialized. He headed deeper into the manor. Nika's brow furrowed, eyes locked on the smooth black of Kochin's funeral suit disappearing down an unlit corridor. There was something about Kochin, the way every word seemed to hold a double meaning, the way he sought her out, only to disdain her. Despite it all, he drew her interest as much as she did his. Nika started after him, turning down the corridor, only to find a long, empty hallway, with all the doors on either side closed. There were no guests here. The siblings had left the lights dimmed, but she heard the rumble of voices down the hallway nonetheless. She followed it, ears trained for Cochin's voice, but finding three others instead. Andow's, Mr. Nem's, and Dr. Santo's.
"Mr. Nem, give the boy some time. This is a funeral," Dr. Santo scolded, his voice emanating from the last door on the left.
Nika crept up to the door, finding it cracked open. She placed her eye up to the opening, knowing that the darkness of the hallway kept her safe, and peered inside. Andow, Dr. Santo, and Mr. Nem were inside, each standing over an armchair as though they'd just risen from their seats.
"I understand your grief. I truly do," Mr. Nem drawled, voice teetering on the edge of sobriety. "But the world does not wait on your grief, Andow. Your father may not have considered war his arena, but your father isn't here to make that decision anymore. Since you now stand in his place, it's your decision whether you'll turn a blind eye while Daltony oppresses our neighbors, or whether you'll use all that influence to stand up for something, to fight for something."
"But my father was a pacifist, Mr. Nem," Andow said. His words were strained, unsure. In the moment, he sounded like just a boy, thrust too soon into a robe three sizes too large.
"But you are not your father."
"That's enough," Dr. Santo said, wagging a stern finger at the glass in Mr. Nem's hand, empty.
"You're drunk, Kenyi. Walk it off, and book a formal appointment with Andow if you wish to discuss this further."
Andow deflated, either from relief or defeat, but Mr. Nem complied. With a shake of his head, he started toward the door. Nika took that as her cue to leave. She scampered around the corner just as Mr. Nem emerged, muttering to himself and stomping down the hall with a half-drunken gait. It wasn't until he was gone and the hallway returned to silence that Nika realized Ven Cochin had disappeared. Having lost Cochin, Nika returned to her corner of the library to finish reading, now with the half-empty wine bottle she'd swiped from the closing bar. She abhorred the taste, but wine had been one thing passed around at family dinners that she'd never gotten to try before, so she drank it now, to make up for lost opportunities. Around her, funeral guests retired home, and before the sun even set, the house had returned to its usual state of quiet. She caught no sign of Mr. Nem or Cochin the rest of the night. When the wine had heated her cheeks, she closed the book and looked up, finding the library newly dark and empty. Even Trin had forgotten to check in on her, but Nika had no reason to stray. Not when they kept her full on dessert and alcohol. Not when she was so, so close. Bottle in hand, she staggered to her feet and traced the walls toward Hendon's room. Even with the door closed, she could hear the mechanical click and whir of the medical machine inside, and something else behind that noise, a quiet, murmured voice. Nika opened the door to find Mimi inside, having pulled up a chair to Hendon's bedside. Mimi startled at her arrival, but when she found only Nika, she put on a languid smile. Her puffy eyes and pink nostrils betrayed the smile, though, and Nika was slow to enter the room.
"Am I intruding?" she asked.
"Not at all," Mimi responded, her voice a tired drawl.
"Is Trin here?"
Nika glanced around the room as she approached the bedside.
"No. Should I be worried?"
Mimi gave her a look under half-lidded eyes.
"If you keep feeding and clothing me, then no."
As Nika passed, she caught a whiff of alcohol, and not from herself. Mimi eyed the bottle and held out her hand. Nika passed it over, thinking Mimi might confiscate it, but instead, the girl downed a generous swig. Heavens, was Mimi drunk? Nika hid her surprise behind narrowed eyes.
"Maybe I'll take that back," she said, reaching for the bottle,
but Mimi shouldered it away like a child with a stolen toy.
"I'm a bad sister," she said, moping at the bedside.
Nika took a seat across from her, surveying Hendon's sleeping form.
"How so?"
"Leaving all the funeral planning to Andow. but I hate funerals. And this one especially.
Don't blame yourself, Mika said, unable to think of anything else more comforting. She'd seldom had to comfort another before. Not with words, anyway.
But I am to blame. I'm sorry we've been so secretive with you, even though we've asked so much, Mimi continued. And I'm sorry if we've made you feel unwelcome despite your services. And I'm sorry—
Mimi, Mika interrupted before the girl could pour any more of her heart out on her drunken tongue.
Stop.
Mimi gave her a fuzzy smile.
Okay.
Her gaze lowered to Hendon.
Have you made any progress with the books?
Mika pulled off a glove, keeping her hand at the bedside to show she was not a threat.
Maybe. That's what I came here to see.
She found Hendon's slack hand beneath the bedsheets and curled her fingers around it. Her influence crossed into his body again, and she found its faculties even more muted than before, as though his systems had entered torpor. She recalled the images of the thalamus in the books, and now climbed to his, pushing through fog and haze. She ascended the spinal column, clawing her way up, vertebra by vertebra, until she sat at the base of the skull. Mika let out a breath, face pinched with concentration as she inched her influence forward. That invisible block met her again somewhere in the brain, and when she tried to balance on that fine point between brainstem and cortex, she found that she couldn't. This was the problem. She was certain of it now. The same way dead tissue in her mother's brain had paralyzed her, there was cell death in Hendon's thalamus that kept him from waking. Nika's soothing drew back into herself, toward her own thalamus, and she mirrored that feeling in Hendon. It wrapped around the blank space of Hendon's brain, drawing a shape out of emptiness, painting in the details of his anatomy as she explored her own, one a template, and the other a fractured copy. When she managed to overlay the two, it was like static crystallizing into music, and she smiled as a new, uncharted structure opened up to her influence. But everything fuzzed as she tried to explore them both, influence drawn too thin between two poles. Hendon's anatomy was still damaged somehow, warped compared to her own. There was a mess of electricity and vasculature there, and though she tried to make sense of it, she was quick to lose her grip on his anatomy. She'd never understood the cells of the brain meticulously enough to know what they were meant to look like. They weren't the same cells she found elsewhere in the body, compartmentalized and structured. These were directional, and she knew if she hitched her influence onto them, she could travel a great distance across the body. But she was merely the rider on an untamed stallion, gripping its mane just to avoid getting bucked. Here, now, while she saw his anatomy mirrored in herself, she had little idea how she might begin fixing it. With a sigh, Mika drew away, her mind settling back into the right body after exploring Hendon's for so long. When her senses returned to her, she found Mimi looking at her hopefully. I understand the problem, Mika offered, anticipating her question. But to draw a man out of a comatose state, that may have been something the old heart suits knew how to do. But not me.
Are you saying you can't do it?
Mimi asked. Her voice trembled dangerously near tears. I'm saying that you and Andau should prepare for a reality where I can't, Mika said. And she knew what her words meant. Prepare for another funeral. Just like this one Mimi hated so much. For a moment, Mimi only stared at her, and Mika feared that, in admitting failure, she would lose all the Kongmi hospitality and find herself back in the dog burrow. Then Mimi's lip quivered, brows knit with uninhibited grief. The tears came shortly after, and the girl buried her face in Hendon's chest before letting out a muffled wail. Her shoulders shook with sobs, and every muscle in Mika tightened. She was too stunned to move. She was the only other person in the room. Was it her place to comfort Mimi? Or was she meant to give Mimi her privacy?
He can't be gone, Mimi cried. How is it that his heart can beat, and his lungs can breathe, and he's alive, but not awake? If he survived where Father hadn't,
only to die 2 weeks later. After all that hope, all that grief, I...
The rest of her words were lost to stuttering hiccups, and Nika grimaced, extending a tentative hand toward Mimi's shoulder. She knew that physical comfort was meant for a situation like this, but she wondered if Mimi would welcome the touch of a blood carver in the place of another, or if that could only bring revolt. When she had sat by her mother's deathbed, her touch had been just a touch. At the end, no soothing nor medicine could cure that extent of sickness, so Nika's hands weren't those of a heart-soothe. When she laced their fingers, her mother's clammy and hers dry, it had just been the touch of a daughter too afraid to let go. Remembering that, Nika dared to extend her hand and squeeze Mimi's shoulder. Mimi didn't stiffen or shudder away. She leaned into the touch, and her sobs calmed, slowly, to shallow gasps. Sitting at the bed, accompanied only by the soft whir of the medical machine and Hendon's quiet breaths, Mimi reminded Nika so much of herself years ago, still grappling with the new concept of death, feeling so betrayed by it because she'd always thought herself immune. She recalled their suspicions of murder. Nika had been in that position too, inventing conspiracy out of death because she'd lost so many. How was it fair when she was a heart-soothe? But finally, when she'd had no one left, she'd come to accept that death didn't conspire to beguile. Death only took and took, and sometimes there was no justice in it at all. Sometimes, death was content to steal the last of a dying lineage by accident and ash, pruning away a family that no longer needed to exist. Surely, that was the same injustice Mimi felt now. The city's most industrial man, felled by a carriage accident? Heart-soothing had never made a difference for Nika, and it seemed that, for all his influence, Mr. Kongmi had still met a mortal fate. When Mimi's whimpers fell to silence, Nika pulled her hand away, eyes exploring the tear-streaked makeup and red-rimmed eyes. Mimi's nose twitched, but she managed to draw back the sobs enough to say, "Does it ever get better?" Nika cocked her head. "You said your family was gone too," Mimi explained. "Does the pain ever get better?" "Yes," Nika said, only because it's what Mimi needed to hear. In truth, it got better, and it didn't. Most days, Nika could forget that she'd ever lost anyone, so occupied with pressing tinctures and scamming clients. But there were days, moments, little things to remind her all over again. An anatomical textbook, a family dinner, a fractured ring. And it would be as though she'd never healed at all. The grief would come with all its claws and teeth, and the scars her heart-soothing could not touch would rupture back into wounds. Instead of all that, she just said, "It will get better." Something crumpled in Mimi's expression.
"There's something I have to tell you. We love Hendon, but it's not the only reason we need him to wake up. It's also because
you believe your father was murdered, and Hendon would know the truth." Mimi blinked in surprise, slow to understand through the wine.
"You know?"
"I overheard it," Nika said. "You should have told me up front." With a look of shame, Mimi lowered her gaze, and Nika watched something mature and sober flicker behind her eyes.
You're right. Please don't think me selfish. Just desperate. If it's too much for you, we can renege on the terms of our agreement. Consider your liberation from the Butcher's Row an act of Kongmi philanthropy. Especially if there's nothing to be done for Hendon."
"I didn't say there was nothing to be done," Nika amended. She wasn't sure why she was so quick to correct Mimi, why she continued to entangle herself in these aristocrats' lives for a simple sum of chem. Giving up felt like more than just forsaking a dying man. It felt like admitting that, even after being given all these resources, she still couldn't learn to heal an injury like her mother's, like she wasn't even a heart-soothe.
"What are you saying?" Mimi asked,
and that youthful hope flickered like a tea light in her soft voice. Nika was saying that she wanted to stay, because the heartache of loss was not something she could soothe away, but a brain injury was. It was too late for her own mother, but there was still hope for the Kongmis. And that's what her grandmother had always told her, right? That the role of a heart soothe was to heal. If she could perform this one act of healing and be true to her family's memory just once in her life, to her mother's fate and her grandmother's teachings, then perhaps she could earn an indelible spot on her bone ring, even if no one would exist to remember it. "I'm saying you shouldn't give up yet," Nika said, and knew her lips would betray her with a promise. "I can heal him." 10. The estate was slow to recover from the funeral. Servants tidied up the dining hall and reawakened automatons, but the somber aura that lingered in the air was not reachable by mop or feather duster. Nika let them work, hiding away in her corner of the manor. Lying atop her bed, she stared at Dr. Santo's business card in her hand. Perhaps she wouldn't be able to join his research initiative, but his invitation had spawned another idea, asking him for literature. The only problem was that talking to Dr. Santo at his workplace incurred the risk of running into his secretary. Not to mention, contacting anyone outside the manor would mean bringing Swan Konika back to life, and she was a charade meant only to last a funeral. Well, a telephone call couldn't hurt. Nika stood, drawing her gloves on before she left her room to find Trin and a telephone. The Kongmis had dropped their guard, perhaps realizing how much food and shelter had placated her, but she didn't want to test their generosity. By now, she knew this manor and its occupants well enough to understand that finding Trin meant asking the staff for Andao. Her inquiry led her to Mr. Kongmi's study, or rather, Andao's now, and she found the door ajar with a sliver of light. "I can't keep going like this." That was Andao's voice, thinned by the usual fatigue. She heard the scratch of a pen, the crumple of paper. "It'll be okay." Trin's voice, softer than she'd ever heard it before. Nika approached the door and peered through the crack. Mr. Kongmi's private study strayed away from the modernity of the rest of the manor, a collection of laden shelves, bulky desks, and sagging furniture beset by a dark, monochromatic setting. Trin and Andao sat across the desk from each other, Trin leaning over with Andao's hand in his. Scrapped paper littered the counter, and Andao hung his head, limp strands of hair falling over his eyes. "What am I supposed to say to him? Nem wants a response. I feel like I've made enemies before I've even had a chance to sit down at Father's desk. How long can I keep stalling before I end up like..." He didn't finish his sentence, but Nika understood the context. "Like my father," he was going to say.
"You won't," Trin said, the words definitive.
"I won't ever, ever let that happen." Their hands melted together. No gloves, just skin on skin. She saw their tender looks, the way their eyes spoke more than their mouths. She caught how their gazes swept over the intimacy of their touch, the closeness of their bodies. And when Trin leaned forward to kiss Andao, she imagined the warmth of it on her own lips. Nika snatched a breath. That was the thing about being a heart soothe. Her body understood how it all felt, because it had seen it all. Sometimes, if she let her empathy organ have its way, she could trick herself into believing she'd experienced those things for herself. Trin pulled back, but the softness lingered.
"Has Nika made any progress?" Andao asked, voice unrestrained.
"We're feeding her, housing her," Trin said. "I wouldn't be surprised if she's taking her time. I hardly understand what she's been up to, but..." He deliberated on his next words. "Not even Dr. Santo has hope for Hendon anymore. She may be our only option."
"Or we accept that maybe we shouldn't bet on miracles where medicine has failed," Andao sighed. "I'm just afraid that Mimi will be crushed."
"I'll take care of Mimi. And Nika. You don't need to worry, Andao."
There it was, that gentleness again. Nika took the opportunity to shoulder her way in, relishing in their flustered expressions. Trin gave her a weary look, his hand still wrapped in Andau's. Their eyes followed her as she took a seat, but she gestured to the rotary dial. "I need to make a phone call, if that's okay." Andau straightened.
"Heaven and earth, Nika. I'm so sorry. We've been so busy that I didn't consider that you might have someone worried about you. Please excuse our—"
She cleared her throat to interrupt him. "I don't. It's for the job." At that, he blinked at her, then recollected himself.
"Oh, of course."
"For what?"
Trin interjected, pulling back from Andau only to cross his arms. Nika gave him a nasty look, beleaguered that she still had to justify herself.
"I've read your library dry, so I was going to ask Dr. Santo if he had anything to offer."
Trin and Andau shared a look of interest.
"Not a bad idea," Andau said.
"Uncle Sean probably has access to the latest research."
Trin crossed his arms, ever skeptical.
"Just be on your best behavior."
"When aren't I?"
Nika dismissed.
"I hope you understand the gravity of the situation," Trin insisted.
Nika thinned her lips in challenge. "Because you suspect someone at the wake murdered Mr. Kongmi?" The room stilled, and Trin's stare turned especially frosty.
"What did we say about eavesdropping?"
"Mimi told me," Nika said.
"Not a full lie." Andau pinched the bridge of his nose in consternation.
"And what is it that she told you, exactly?"
"That you believe your father was murdered, and you want me to wake Hendon for answers," she said.
"Not just for answers," Andau responded quickly. "He means a lot to our family. But—"
His words were lost to another sigh, as though he'd lost the energy to explain.
"But Hendon would be able to tell us for sure if there was foul play involved,"
Trin finished. They were coordinated, the two of them, finishing sentences as though they were tethered by the brain. Nika shook her head.
"If you're unsure, why speculate at all?"
"I know it sounds unlikely, but we have our reasons," Andau said.
"Like?"
"The night before the accident, Mimi overheard him arguing with someone on the phone. Threats were exchanged. We don't know who the caller was."
She wasn't wholly convinced.
"So what do you know?"
"We know Father was meant to make a public appearance to announce his new automaton line, but none of the auto carriages would start,"
Andau added, growing adamant.
"We know he went by horse carriage, along a path the horses have traveled a dozen times before. We know they were spooked around a curve. What's more, they were dead on sight. The only thing we don't know was what happened the day of the accident."
"And that's where Hendon came in," Nika supposed. "Where she came in." "You suspect someone from Mr. Kongmi's inner circle because of the phone call," she guessed. Andau shook his head.
"Not only because of a phone call. My father was a well-loved man, but one doesn't get to where he was without making enemies. And for people like him, like us, our greatest rivals stand within our friends, our colleagues."
"Where was all this information when we were rehearsing my backstory?" Nika grumbled. Andau gave her a meek smile.
"We didn't think it mattered."
"Why wouldn't it matter?"
"Because you're here for a job," Trin said, not so apologetic. "You should consider yourself lucky. Home nurses don't get the room and board you do."
There was something more to be said, that heart-soothing was so much more intimate than medicine, so she was more entwined than a home nurse could be, that she was sleeping under their roof, listening in on their conversations, at once privy to their secrets and excluded from them, that this was such a half-welcome, allowing her to dine with the semblance of a family for the first time in 6 years, yet keeping her in the same corner of the manor as a comatose body. But Trin was right. This was just a job with a generous payment and the added perk of their amenities. Perhaps she'd mistaken proximity for trust.
"You think your father may have been killed for political reasons? The candidacy?" she asked instead.
Andau gave her an uncertain nod.
"It's certainly a motive. My father tried to keep his candidacy plans quiet, but when he aced the candidate placement exams, word got out.
With the candidacy, his enemies no longer cared about wealth. They wanted power.
Same thing, no?
Andow tweaked the corner of his lip. Nuance, especially with war talks. Nika had seldom considered the war. That was a far-off prospect, teased too often and with too little action to be taken seriously. She knew war raged around Thumis, and Daltony's naval base on Yarong loomed like a threat to the south, but she was too absorbed in her own life to consider fighting for another's.
"So that's what you and Mr. Nem were talking about last night," she murmured to herself, and watched Trin's eyes twitch with annoyance.
"Really? Eavesdropping again?" he said, sounding exasperated. She waved an indifferent hand.
"I was just passing by. What exactly is it that he wanted from you?"
Again, Andow and Trin traded their uncertain looks, speaking full sentences with their eyes alone, until Andow said,
"He wants me to endorse the war with the Kongmi name. And, if war comes, he wants me to divert my factories to the war effort."
Nika barked out a laugh. "Well, there's your murderer. Kill the pacifist father, influence the impressionable son. He gets his war, his artillery industry booms, and he becomes a leading candidate as a bonus." Andow winced. Trin's expression flattened with distaste, and Nika realized she'd pricked a vein too deep.
Sobering, she added, "What is it that you want?"
Andow shook his head.
"If I knew, Nem would already have his answer."
He waved a hand, dashing the topic. "Anyway, you wanted me to dial Uncle Sean?"
Nika drew out the business card and offered it to him. She would have dialed it herself, but she'd never used a telephone before. Never had anyone to call. "He gave me this office line."
"I haven't memorized," Andow said, rejecting the card and swiveling the dial.
Nika watched him enter the number, the frontal circular apparatus clicking as it rotated, until at last he held the telephone out to her. Trin leaned closer.
"Oh, we're all going to listen in?" she asked pointedly, but accepted it nonetheless.
She held it as she'd seen it held before, but Andow silently gestured for her to flip it around. A mechanical buzzing noise greeted her ear when she did. She looked at Andow in question, but he merely mouthed, "Wait." After a moment, something clicked on the other side.
"Dr. Santo's office."
It was Cochin's voice on the line. Caught by surprise, Nika floundered for words, though she should have expected the aide to manage the phone line. At last, she managed,
"It's Swan Konika."
"Ah, Ms. Swan."
She could hear the disappointment in his voice.
"I wasn't expecting a call from you."
"Well, I won't be in town for too long."
She said this to appease Trin, and looked deliberately at him to make sure he understood that.
"So, I thought I might use my resources while I have them."
"Do you mean Dr. Santo's research initiative?"
The hesitance was palpable in his tone.
"I was actually interested in what kind of literature he might have access to."
"Well, I have some things that might interest you, if you'd like to plan a time to meet in private," he offered.
Trin shook his head with stern disapproval, but it wasn't as though she were planning to meet with Cochin alone anyway.
"I was hoping to just set up a meeting with Dr. Santo. Is that within your ability as his aide?"
"Of course," he said, but instead of annoyance, she heard amusement in his voice. "I can make an appointment."
"Perhaps sometime soon? My schedule is quite strict."
She said that last word as another jab toward Trin. The line went silent for a pause, and Nika wished she had a number to bypass Cochin and speak directly to Dr. Santo, because she didn't fully trust him not to end the call right then. Thankfully, he said,
"He seems to be free at noon. The address is on the card. I assume you kept that?"
"I'll stop by then," she said, and it was Trin who ended the call before Cochin could, finger pressing down a button on the stand.
She handed the receiver back to Andow.
"All right, I'll be off now."
Nika pushed herself off the desk toward the door, but Trin stepped before her.
"I'll go with you," he said,
and it wasn't so much an offer as it was a statement. She gave Trin a tired look and glanced to Andow for reason.
"Surely it would raise questions if I showed up with your 6-foot bodyguard."
I'd feel a lot better if you didn't go alone, Andow said, and she realized he wouldn't take her side on this one. Please, Nika. Trin knows Dr. Santo and his people. It's just to ensure that we don't have any social mishaps. She looked between Andow and Trin, wishing Mimi was here to defend her. As she'd observed, that was the hierarchy within this family. The household deferred to Trin, Trin deferred to Andow, and they both deferred to the whims of the little sister. But she let out a defeated sigh, knowing it was futile. Fine. But if I'm to jump through all your hoops just to heal Hendon, I need you to tell me things. I want to be in the know, she said, using the moment to leverage what she could. You can't ask me to practice discretion when I don't know what to be discreet about. Andow sighed behind a thin smile. You're right. You deserve to know. Even Trin looked agreeable, confirming with a terse nod.
Very well.
Good, she grumbled, but her chest bloomed with warmth at their consideration, like she just earned her first real foothold in this home. Let's go, Trin. Trin shifted his jaw. Please?
There we go,
he said, sounding satisfied with himself, and stepped out of the office. Nika gave Andow an incredulous look. You two are involved? I wasn't aware he was capable of emotion. A soft look came over Andow's eyes.
It's not about what he says, but what he does.
Isn't that what you hire him for? To do things? That elicited a laugh from him.
He's hired only to keep me alive. Yet, I wouldn't want to live without him.
With no argument for that, Nika turned from the room and followed after Trin. 11. The medical center, a modern construction, hardly looked like it belonged in the city. It was all arches and windows, straying from the traditional pagoda architecture, but for its tiered, curved roofing. In a way, it more resembled a university, from whose libraries Nika had stolen books before, than a hospital. But then again, Nika had rarely frequented hospitals, not even when her mother was sick on her deathbed, because hers had been an illness neither heart-soothing nor modern medicine could solve. She checked the address on the card out of habit, as if this grand building would be anything but the Thumis Medical Center. Trin held open the doors for her. She felt out of place entering through the front doors, despite her clean dress and scrubbed skin. Thankfully, the bustle of people in the lobby seemed too busy to notice her. Trin studied the directory at the stairs.
Fourth floor, he said. Let's go.
Does it hurt you to smile? She asked, watching his stony expression as they ascended the stairs. If it's a musculature problem, I could probably soothe that out. He flinched, eyes wide.
Don't mention that here, Nika.
An impish giggle bubbled out from her. Relax, no one's listening. The stairwell and halls were empty, and no one would understand what it meant to soothe rather than carve anyway.
Still, do you know what physicians might do with a...
He caught himself.
With you?
Of course she knew. When Daltony took over Yarong, many of its residents went to labor camps to build a new naval base. Only the Heartsus were exempt from labor, at first a blessing, until the researchers attempted to determine what exactly made a Heartsu tick, and if they ever found an answer before they cut through all the native Yarongese Heartsus, they hadn't shared it with the rest of the world. Thumis had its own problems, but at least she didn't have to worry about getting vivisected here. When she looked at Trin, his frown was etched with genuine concern, and her retort stuck in her throat like a hiccup. I appreciate the concern, but I'm not worried, she said, hoping to lighten his anxiety. Trin let out a strained breath.
Mimi, but now all of us, brought you into this mess. I'm not sure the siblings could forgive themselves if something happened to you because of it.
It's nothing new to me. My life was already a mess before I entered this one. She remembered her tinctures, the little attic room she'd rented out. Nika wondered what had become of it with her absence, with her rent due at the end of the month. Back then, she lived day by day,
never trying too hard to sort out her future because she figured, with her family's track record, she'd never make it particularly far. And so, the troubles had piled. Her clients inevitably saw her for the sham she was, and she never stayed in any corner of the city for long.
"Because of your magic?"
he asked, the last part a whisper. Nika measured his expression. Small talk or genuine interest? For once, it was hard to tell. "Yes, in part, because of my gift."
"Why don't you just not use it?"
That was a genuine but foolish question. She opened her mouth to answer him. Would he not fly if he had wings? But she didn't know how to express the answer in a way he would understand. Surely he didn't see heart-soothing the same way she did. Because how could he? How could he understand that it was her connection to her lost family, a culture she'd never had the privilege of truly knowing? How could he know how it felt to soothe, to connect to someone so intimately, not a mere substitute for empathy, but a step above it? How could he see that it was not some magic she could switch on and off at whim, but a permanent fixture of her identity? These thoughts simmered under her tongue, but all she said was, "Because it's fun." He snorted, but from his smirk alone, it was hard to tell if he was ridiculing her or if he saw through her. He left it at that, and they reached the fourth floor. Dr. Santo's office was at the end of the hall, the door marked by a frosted window and a plaque with his name, Santo Keyshawn. Nika rapped a knuckle against the door, to no response. She gave it another second, then tried the handle. It opened into a barren waiting room, with a curved desk and its empty chair. The place was austere, despite its windows, lounge chairs lined meticulously. She and Trin took their seats, him sitting across from her, even though there was perfectly enough space to sit beside her. Nika frowned at his apprehension, his stiff-backed posture and hands folded in his lap. "Afraid I'm going to try something?" she asked.
"No, just never liked hospitals," he admitted,
flicking quick glances at the door as though a corpse might walk through.
"So cold. Aseptic."
She understood that. The sweet smell of carbolic acid had followed them into the office, and the office was a few degrees removed from warmth. But hospitals had always held her fascination. Nika was intrigued about the tools they invented, the procedures they used to mimic what a heart soothe could do in a breath. Still, there were things medicine could fix that she could not. Systemic things, microbe infections, and diseases so dispersed through the body that her influence could not handle it all at once. From her history lessons, she recalled how Daltony had utilized those limitations to conquer Yarong, defeating them with weapons to circumvent heart-soothe mending, diseases that spread readily through touch, and firearms that rained death from a distance. "Never been in one before?" she asked, a part of her hoping she wasn't alone in that.
"I've been